first of all, I'm going to say a prayer to Mother Sri is the deity of wisdom. In Mahayana tradition, the Buddha that expresses the wisdom of Buddha. And the wisdom of Buddha is the doctrine of emptiness, is his teaching. So I want to say a prayer to Mother Sri, who happens to be also my Buddha form. So I have it in English here. You can read along if you guys want to. And I'm going to read it in Tibetan. Lama dango go jambe yana cha se lo Gangi lo to te ni chinda ni ta nam da ra se we ji Ne don Konji shin ji te ni ki tu ka le kam te Gang da tsi pe to na ma re mon pa Tom du ne ki te we Jo cha ko na wu ji ta se yen la tu chi yang den to Do ta cha cha no mo ni long Ne ki cha 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 te ti ma ri ngon se ju ne Nyu ji ne cho Se re de na du ne da jing sa chi ta san yun de Du tso kya tse tu wo ku Chu da chu dan chi ni gen te ta de mun se shan pe yang la du Omaravatsanadi, Se denke gitenra, Otse gita daiti mumun zera zene, Kada tenja jono tokayi, Nojo kope na kwaze duzo. So that's a prayer that the Buddha may clear our minds of ignorance. And what we're studying today is the release from ignorance, basically. This is the most important thing that anyone can teach. And I take this very, very seriously. I've spent more than 1,000 days of my life, morning, noon, and night, just studying this. So this is something that I take extremely seriously because it alone is the teaching that releases us from samsara. So this is an extremely important teaching. The first thing we have to realize is that the nature of mind, any mind, any sentient being, whether it be a kitty or a person or a dog, is that it doesn't want to suffer, that it fears suffering and that it wants to be happy. That's the basic level of mind. Everything that we do, everything that we think about is basically comes out of that. Everything is rooted down in this fundamental nature of not wanting to suffer and wanting to be happy. And the discovery of that is easy for all of us to get, and it was quite easy for the Buddha to understand, because as soon as he saw suffering in the story of his life, which is for us a kind of parable, is that as soon as he saw it, he knew he didn't want it. And as soon as he saw, was old enough to understand what death was, As soon as he was old enough to understand what suffering was, mental and physical suffering, he realized that it was horrible, that he didn't want it. And it scared him so much that he gave up everything to find a way, was there some solution to this? I mean, basically his story is a story of a life that finally realized what suffering was. And he really got the first noble truth. That's his life before being a Buddha is all about that. That's what it's basically about. It's a story that teaches us that if we really understand the first noble truth, we're going to be obsessed with finding a solution to it. And he saw it in the story. I don't know if it was that easy for him, if it was just like going out one day and finally seeing it, or if it was seeing it in partly like his teachers dying or people getting old in the palace or wherever he lived. it takes a lot for us to get profoundly what suffering is and how pervasive it is, that we can't escape it anyway. We can't figure it out. We can't take the right drugs. We can't stay young long enough. We can't stay well long enough. We can't fix everything in our house to be a palace so that nothing bad happens. It never can be eliminated, no matter what we do. We work for an NGO. We're really smart. We're a doctor. We can fix diseases and stuff. There is no solution to it. We constantly come up against it. We just think we've got it right, and it's back in our faces again. And when we really understand that we haven't got any way to escape it in ordinary life, it could either be really depressing or it could be motivating. And for the Buddha, it was motivating. For the Buddha, it was the motivation for him to completely change his life, to really devote himself to finding the solution if there was one. And he didn't have anybody to look at and say, hey, you can do this. There is a solution. For him, it was at a time where there wasn't. Open that door just a teeny bit further. she can't get her shoulders out. There, that's enough. She's like with her head outside. that's desire for you. So anyway, for him, there wasn't anybody to teach him. He didn't follow a Buddha. He didn't have like a book he could read where, hey, there's a solution. He went out and just said, I got to figure this thing out. I'm going to figure this thing out or die figuring this thing out, which is an incredibly brave and determined thing to do. I mean, the kind of karma you have to do that is incredible. So in some paths of Buddhism, we say that Buddha did that to show us that he had already realized enlightenment, that he did this as a teaching to show us that this is what we basically have to do too. In other paths of Buddhism, they say that Buddha realized enlightenment in that life. So it depends on which path you take. So, I mean, some of the traditions say that he achieved enlightenment in that life. Some traditions say he already did, and he came back and showed us this with his lifetime, that this was a demonstration. But the important thing is that he was scared to death. He was scared to death, that it made him drop everything. And I think if you really understand suffering, you really want to find a solution to it. And the Four Noble Truths are the essence of Buddhism. They're the essence of Buddhism. So the First Noble Truth addresses this nature of our mind. I mean, the Buddha, first of all, he doesn't talk about nature of mind, but actually he is talking about it, because all of our mental states cause suffering. All of our desires, all of our thinking, all of our perceptions have embedded in them something that causes suffering. That's the First Noble Truth. It isn't that the objects are contaminated first, it's that our minds are contaminated first. So we have to do something about these minds. And this is what leads to the second of the Four Noble Truths, which is the doctrine of emptiness. And he teaches the doctrine of emptiness because he realizes what the problem is underneath each and every one of our contaminated mental states. What is it that leads to our suffering in our relationships? What is it that leads to our suffering having to be born and to have to die? What is it that leads to aging? What is it that leads to contaminated environments that collapse and we starve to death? It's our karma and our delusion, deluded minds, and those are the same thing, basically. It's a delusion. And this is what comes to the second noble truth, which is his whole idea of no self, or selflessness, or emptiness, or however you express it in your tradition. So he tells us, he teaches that if we understand that things have no self, that we won't suffer anymore. He teaches us that there's one road to liberation, and it's the doctrine of emptiness. It's this doctrine of no-self. That if we fully realize the selflessness of things, our suffering will be cut off and we'll be liberated. There's only one thing, and this is it. And to have figured that out is enough for me to bow down to the Buddha. I mean, the fact that somebody could have figured out beyond, you know, trying to fix up your room or your house or something, beyond my psychology and Freud, you know, some therapist trying to make me feel better, actually to find out what all of the problems are rooted in, the reason I'm born into suffering, that I die in suffering, the reason that every day I'm trying to escape suffering, the reason that I'm pervaded by suffering, that I'm ready to suffer at any moment, I just get comfortable and somebody turns up the heat outside and I'm now uncomfortable. Why is that? Why am I so set up for suffering all the time? Why do I constantly have to deal with it and find a way out of it? What is the problem? And the problem is that I perceive self, that I perceive I have a wrong view, basically. A wrong view. Buddha said, Buddha found this out by himself. But in general, we don't find this out by ourselves. Generally speaking, we learn this from somebody. It's not that you can't come to see it by yourself, by studying, but generally speaking, we learn this through the kindness of a teacher. And that's why teachers are so important, because a teacher is someone like His Holiness has taught me, and he teaches everyone. He very often teaches this teaching. And that I learned it in a book from a teacher who had a teacher who taught him how to understand this. Because this is not an easy thing to understand. Even though it's so basic, it's not a very easy thing to understand. It's a very easy thing to misunderstand. And because it's so basic, it's subtle. There's something subtle about it. It's not immediately obvious what the problem is. And I think that they always say that being taught this is the biggest gift you can get. It's more than the gift of life from your parents. It's more than anything your friends do for you. It's more than anything that you can buy. You can't buy it. You can't pay for it. There's nothing that can pay you back for this, because this is the end of samsara for you. If you really get this, if you really spend time studying this and incorporating this into your practice and into your life, it's the solution to everything. It's the final solution. To use a Nazi term. It is finally, this is the end of suffering. And it's the only thing that can do this. There's more to the Buddhist path. There's more about compassion, for example, in the Mahayana tradition. There's more about omniscience and getting rid of things. But this is the basis of being a Buddhist. This is of the four seals, this is the second of the four seals. The second thing that makes you a Buddhist is to have the Buddhist view of no self. This is what makes you a Buddhist. This is what gives you liberation. This is what stops all your suffering. This is what could stop most of your suffering in this life. And if you have a direct realization of emptiness as an arhat or as a bodhisattva or so on, this is what stops it forever. You never suffer again if you get this. Which is an incredible thing, because that's all your mind is about. That's all anything you're doing is about, is trying to have that happen. So this is an incredible, and it requires a teacher. So anyway, I decided to do it in terms of two books, which you could easily get. One is the eighth chapter of the book, How to Practice by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. And one is a chapter 4 of the Four Noble Truths book by His Holiness. Yeah. And this is a really good book. They're both really, really good books. But the problem is, this is quite a difficult doctrine, and different kinds of Buddhist schools or different kinds of traditions teach it a little bit differently. And it's very difficult to teach somebody from different traditions. It's very difficult. And the only way I can do that is I have to teach it from the one I practice, which is the Prasangika Madhyamaka view, which is the same one that His Holiness will teach from, which ultimately is the view that even that arhat in the Theravadan tradition, if they realize emptiness directly, it's this view that they ultimately realize, which is the emptiness of all phenomena, not just a self of persons, but a self of all phenomena. Because once you realize the emptiness of one thing, Buddha said, you realize the emptiness of everything. So it extends beyond, if you have a direct realization, if you finally really understand emptiness, you'll understand it applies to everything. It'll apply to doors and tables and chairs, as well as to people. So it's not just no self in the sense of no self of persons, but it'll be the no self or the no findability of anything around you. So that's really important. So anyway, I'm going to teach it from the Prasangika view, and but I'm going to do it really briefly because there's a lot of ins and outs to this. And like I said, I spend a lot of time. there are a lot of this thing has to be made your own. I mean, you need to make this your own. And you're going to have to do meditation on it, and you have to spend time with it. Because as you spend time with it, your understanding of it deepens with every day that you think about it, whether you're meditating or not meditating. And I find that over the years, my appreciation of it and my understanding of it deepens all the time. And it gets funnier and more amusing, and then also more upsetting and more profound. It makes me laugh at everything, and it makes me less tied into my emotions and less tied into wanting to possess things or have things. It makes things lighter. Sort of the unbearable lightness of being, as Kaczynski says in his book, it becomes like everybody's obsessions become lighter, my obsessions become lighter, my living becomes lighter, I need less and less. The reason I need less and less is because I can't find the things. There's nothing there to need, really. I just need the basics. I have to eat and sleep. By it. You know what I mean? It's just like, I need enough to live so I can practice. That's what I need. And it isn't giving up anything. As time goes on, it isn't giving up anything. So it's like, it's a renunciation based on an understanding. It's not a renunciation that's like tearing things away. It's just it's a renunciation based on the years that I've spent doing this practice. And as I do so, I have more sympathy for people. And I have more compassion based on that because I realize the terrible toll that the wrong view takes on all of us all the time, and how unhappy it makes all of us, and how driven it makes all of us, and how we end up doing constantly, as Shantideva says in the ways of the Bodhisattva, although we want to be happy, everything we do is to pursue unhappiness. And it makes for a more profound understanding of all the Four Noble Truths, of all of Buddha's teaching, of compassion, of understanding other people. It's the key, the peace of mind. And years ago I decided that was what I wanted. I was sick and tired from the struggle of this mind. And so, when I started studying this, I saw this is it. And I've convinced myself by my own work and my own practice that it actually works. So I can bow down to Buddha now. In all sincerity, I don't bow down to people. But Buddha I can bow down to. Because to figure this out is just incredible. And that this holiness has been my teacher. He's devoted his lifetime to going around teaching people that I can bow down to him. And I can bow down to my teachers in India because they helped me deepen this understanding, so I can bow down to them. So, here we go. When I think about myself, we'll do ourselves because that's the easiest thing because we have such a sense of ourself. When I think of myself, I have just any thought about myself. not anything deep, not analyzing too much or anything. I have two views of myself. One is okay, valid, and one is wrong. The valid sense I have of myself is there is a person named Christine. There's a person. And she has experiences and she changes over time. And one day she's pretty happy and the next day she's exhausted. And now I'm doing this and now I'm engaging in this. And sometimes she does positive things and sometimes she does negative things. I have this idea of myself as this mere person that engages in good and bad deeds, that helps people and doesn't help people, that is this mind and body in some sense. Just as I appear, just as I immediately appear to be involved in things. That's okay. But mixed in with that view of myself, inseparably for people and for animals. Now, animals have the same thing. They don't have a sophisticated mental system, but they have the same thing. They have that same sense of themselves as something that needs to eat. I'm hungry. I want to go out. I'm happy. I'm not happy. Blah, blah, blah. They have that kind of mere sense of self, that kind of appearance to themselves of the self. But mixed in with that is another view, and this is wrong. And this is that somewhere, they're findably, substantially, concretely there, findably there, that they could be held onto, grasped onto, found, that they're permanently something. Now, even cats and dogs have this, bugs have this. And it's mixed up with this sort of mere appearance of ourselves is a further feeling that we're findably, concretely there. And the way we get at this, the way that Buddha gets at this and teaches this, and the way the different traditions teach this, requires analysis, because we need to pull these two things apart. One's okay, but one's not okay. So what we have to do is we have to engage in philosophy a little bit, because this is why we need a teacher. Because these two things are married as if they're the one thing in our ordinary experience. Every time I open my eyes, the thing merely appears to me and immediately there it is inside of me. As soon as I think about myself, I merely appear to myself as a complex of mind and body, but then immediately there's something there that's me. As if there's something inside, some invisible soul or some invisible entity or some kind of thing inside of all that that's me. And I'm going to protect that from you, and I'm going to try to grab onto that in somebody else that I want to keep. There's this kind of substantial, concrete thing there. And what we do in Buddhist philosophy is we work at pulling those apart, and then philosophically, theoretically, we work at pulling those apart in our mind so that we can meditate in a way that we can focus on the wrong view and realize in our meditation that wrong concept, that wrong view, the object of that wrong view, that non-existent thing, is not there, and that we can't find it. And we in our meditation, not finding it is what we focus on. So we go and we try to find this thing that we think is really there, this self. And we usually start as a self of persons. Although it's taught with the self of objects in the Madhyamaka tradition, I don't know how it's taught in the Theravadan tradition exactly, but we do this thing, analysis of a chariot, or, okay, a car, or an object, right? But generally speaking, our meditation process starts with a self of persons. Because we have such a sense of ourselves that as soon as we unlock our wrong view of ourselves, we immediately start unlocking our wrong view of everything else. Because the mind is like me. The objects turn out to be the objects of this thing that I can't find, right? And as soon as I can't find that, the connection with those objects starts to loosen up. So we start with the self of persons. And in the Madhyamaka tradition, we say the self of objects is a little more subtle and difficult, but actually I find it easier because we tend to like hide out in different parts, whereas the table can't really hide out. It can't hide out in a mind, you know. It's just a material object, so if you can't find a table or a chair, well, yeah. But the problem is that we're the most complex object, and we're most palpably real to ourselves, so they usually start with the self object. But anyway, so there's these two aspects, this valid sense of I or self, and this invalid sense, this concrete. Now, Buddhists aren't the only guys who had this. Believe it or not, the Buddhist tradition came out of India from a philosophical tradition of the idea of a self. That Buddha was able, there was a very sophisticated philosophical tradition in India 2,500 years ago, 500 BC. It's an extremely sophisticated system. And that's why Buddha could be there and teach this. Because you need a quite sophisticated philosophical system of understanding to be able to start pulling these things apart. India was very advanced philosophically. But it turns out that actually the West was pretty advanced, not very long thereafter. And we had exactly the wrong, same wrong view. And we held on to the same wrong view that the Buddhists in the pre-Buddhist tradition in India had. So if you study Western philosophy, which was my major in college, you will study exactly the same wrong views that Buddha tells us that are wrong views in the Buddhist tradition. So you don't have to know all the fancy names in the Buddhist tradition. Actually, if you did study Western philosophy, you'd see the same wrong views. The same idea about the substantial thing that's somehow in there. The Greeks had that same view. And that same view was around at least within 100 years of the Buddha, at least about the time of the Buddha. In the West, we were having the same stuff. Philosophy starts in the West about 500 BC. Well, it didn't start in India in 500 BC because that's when Buddha was there. But we developed, it's a natural thing. Because why? Why does this wrong view philosophically develop? Because it's a natural, innate wrong view in us. It's natural to the way we see things that we see things that way. So it is natural that a philosopher thinking about how we see things would develop a philosophical or a theoretical view that would express the wrong view that is innate in every perception. But the important thing to understand is this isn't just a philosophical mistake. Everybody has this mistake. Bugs have this mistake. People have this mistake who don't practice philosophy. So it isn't just that philosophers got it wrong, or pre-Buddhist philosophers got it wrong, or whatever. This is, you get it wrong. I get it wrong. Every time I wake up in the morning, I open my eyes, and there is a real, substantially, inherently existent world. Blue things out there, red things out there. That's how I see them. That's how I experience them. So I not only see them as merely just appearing. I see them as appearing and being in themselves what they are, findably in themselves what they are. So this is not just a philosophical doctrine. But the important thing is that we can use a philosophy to help undo it. And that's what Buddha teaches when he teaches the doctrine of no self. That form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. So what are we empty of? What is this self that we're not? Now, in different schools, it's expressed in different ways, but I've got a text from the Western tradition. And this is somebody I studied in 1972 with my philosophy professor, who was my root lama and remains my root lama. He taught me how to think. I remember one day he came to class and asked if we'd read. It wasn't this class, but it was, I think, 1971, and had everybody done their reading, and most of the people said no, so he closed his book and he left. What was that teaching? Left. I was sitting there, and I was devastated. And I told him this about 5 years ago. I said, I still remember that, you know, that you closed your book and you walked out. And he didn't remember doing it. I said, it was the most shocking thing that ever happened. I must have had a bad day that day. I said, whatever it was, it had told me that if I didn't care about this, I didn't deserve to learn about it. And I cared desperately. I'd done the homework. This was my life, right? But it was really one of his main teachings to me that he did that. And he was teaching me how to think. He was teaching me the two wrong views. He was teaching me the extreme of realism and the extreme of nihilism. He was teaching me that things, neither did they exist substantially, inherently, findably in themselves, neither did they not exist. He was trying to teach me how to philosophize. And it was just incredible, and I never forget that. And he's the most important person in my life because he was my teacher. He taught me how to think. And I'm in contact with him, and in the spring I'll go spend a week with him and his feet in Wisconsin, my philosophy teacher. And we'll talk about non-fundability, because that's what we're going to talk about. So anyway, I wanted to read you this passage from, I gave away all my books when I went to India, and I called him up and I said, I don't have my books, but I want to read this book again, so he sent it to me in and it still had the receipt in it from the year when we studied this book together. And it smells like you, and it smells like his office, because that's where I've been for 40 years, 35 years. Okay, so this is it. Let us see what kind of idea we would have about the being of things. Try to figure out, what are we denying? What are we trying to say doesn't exist? What is this wrong view that we're getting at? For example, the horse we see in the circus. What is the being, that the thing that is the horse? We have before us his shape, his color, the resistance offered by his body. Is that the horse? Is that its reality? Yes or yes and no. The horse isn't its shape alone, because it's also its color, and so on. Color, shape, and resistance to touch are things which are different than themselves. The horse is all of them together, or better, a unit, a thing in which those other things are joined. But that thing in which color, form, and so on are united is not yet visible. I assume it. I invent it. It is my interpretation of the observable facts which consist in the persistence with which colors and shapes and so on continually appear together. The true being of the horse, it seems, is behind its apparent visible, tangible elements. It's a thing which is latent under those present things, color, shape, and so on. A thing, then, which is thought of as a unitary support for those other things which I call the qualities of a horse, not properly speaking, the horse itself. Therefore, the being of this animal is not its visible and apparent being, but on the contrary, something in which it's in which supports its appearances, its substratum being made up of qualities, the being which is underneath or behind them, their substantial being. In Western terms, this is called substance, the substance in Western philosophy, substantia. Substance, then, is a thing I assume to be behind what I see of that thing, of its appearances. But no, in addition, the horse moves, changes the color of his skin with the years, and even changes his shape with work. Therefore, his appearances are infinite. If the horse were to consist of his appearances, he would not be one horse, but an infinite number of horses, all different. That is to say that horse would be this and that and the other, and therefore neither this nor that or the other. But let us suppose that under those appearances, there's a thing which is invisible and permanent, which produces those appearances one after the other. Then we can say that there are changes in one single unitary being, the substance called horse. While the same horse may shift in shape, bulk, and color, while he changes in appearance, he has in reality a being which is both quiet and immutable. The substance, in addition to being the support of his qualities, is the permanent subject of their accidents or variations. There you have it in a nutshell. That's how we see things. Basically, that's how we see things. There's some invisible Tara holding up all the many Tara appearances, holding them all together, being the same thing under all that different. Tara is a baby. Tara is 12. Tara is 24. Tara is 66. Tara, whatever. Tara with long hair, short hair. There's nothing ever remaining. Tara with these cells. Tara with those cells. Everything changing constantly, but we have this feeling that there's this thing there that doesn't change. That I was the same thing when there was this me that was in 2-year-old Christine that's now still here in almost 57-year-old Christine. There's this unchanging essence. I've never seen it. Everything I see is not Christine. I see a face. Is a face Christine? No. Is the shape Christine? No. Because if this shape is Christine, which one? The one from the side? The one from the front? If that's Christine, then that's Christine. That's it. I point to it and say, that's it. 12-year-old Christine did not have that shape. 2-year-old Christine did not look like did not have that face, did not have that form, did not have that color. In fact, I hardly had any hair, but I had blonde, white blonde hair. I didn't have gray hair. If I say that there's this findable, substantial thing that never changed, I have to be able to point to it and find it. If that really exists, I have to find it. I feel that it's findably here. I experience everything as if I could point to it and say, there it is, that's it. That's my horse. That's my girlfriend. That's my bed. That's my book. That's my teacher's book. This one. I had one too. It would look exactly like this, but this is my teacher Fred's book, my professor's book, right? And I don't want you to take this book away from me. But if I look for the book that is Fred's book, it's not a smell. It's not a page. So if this page is this page the book, no. I'll put all the not book Fred's book things on a pile. Or put all the not Christine things on a pile. And I'll end up with everything that I can experience about Christine except the Christine that I thought I found there. There was never a findable Christine in this room. There is not a findable Christine now, and there never will be. But there is a person named Christine. But there's not this substantially existent entity that I can point to and find and say, that's it. What is there? There's merely all these appearances, all this change, all this flow of mental states, all this merely designated stuff that I over and over say is Christine. What is it that I'm not? I'm not this thing that I feel that I am. At my core, I really feel that I'm this findable thing here. I have to stop and think about it to undo that. I have to stop and do a meditation. And that's why we do meditation on emptiness. We try to identify that concrete sense of ourself in our meditation. We try to get a sense of this object, this way of being, this object that exists in a certain way, this Christine that exists as this findable thing. We try to get that really clear before our minds, and then we try to find it. We go through all of the things that appear to us, I think. I have this feeling always that I'm like behind my eyes. I don't know. Most people in the West think that they're somewhere in their head. Tibetans tend to think that they're somewhere in their chest, and Indians tend to think that they think out of this place. We don't think out of that place. We always think of ourselves out of our heads, usually. So there's a sense that we're somehow in our heads. But if you grab my leg, I feel like I'm in my leg. If you grab my hand, I have a feeling that you've just grabbed me, right? So I kind of slip around in there, but our general feeling is, I always start with my head because that's where I feel I am mostly. Especially when I'm thinking, I feel like I'm in my head. And I think, what's there? And then I go through myself physiologically. And I think, what's in there? There's eyeballs, and what's behind the eyeballs? There's bones around it, there's gray matter, there's blood vessels, and I'm not a blood vessel. So I put the blood vessel over there, I put the bone over there, I put the eyeballs over there, and I end up with, there's nothing there. Then I think, well, it must be someplace else, right? And then it must be maybe someplace in my chest or something, you know, when somebody grabs me, you pinch me or something, you hurt me. Well, that's okay, is it there? You know, and I go through my whole body that way. I look every part of my body, and there's not that thing that I feel. Although sometimes I feel that that thing is what I look like. But when I really analyze and try to find it, this thing that I feel is so there, it just slips through my fingers like dust. So I go through the whole body. I put all the things that aren't Christian mentally on a pile, and I end up with a pile of all this arms, legs, bodies, trunk, hair, face, form. But none of those is me. I'm not a form. I'm not a hair. I'm not a color. I'm not a skin. I'm not a bone. I'm not a bone. I'm not a bone. I'm not a brain. I'm not any of those things. I'm not cells. I'm not feet. I have feet. I have hair. I am white. I am female, but I'm not a body, right? So then it seems like, well, it's something else than those things. And then I go through my mind. Am I this thought of me? Am I that thought of me? If I was the thought of me when I remember very clearly scenes from my childhood, sitting and thinking, what is me? And when I thought about me, there was a real distinct thought of Christine. Am I that thought of Christine? Well, if I am, then as soon as that thought ends, which it surely does, because all of a sudden my attention is dragged outside for a bird call, and then does that mean Christine just disappeared? Because that thought is done. All the thoughts I had of Christine when I was growing up, they're all gone. That means if any of those thoughts of me were me, there is no me left. If one of them was me, then it had to always be me because that's what it is to be me. But it's gone. So I have these experiences of like me. So if it's not that, what is it? Is it something more basic, like just some mental essence or something? And then you have to say, which mental state is it? Is it this one? Is it that one? And as you do the analysis, what happens is, it slowly starts to undermine this sense that there's something there that is immutably, unchangeably this thing that is yourself. This findable Christine. And that's what we do over and over and over again. We go into the meditation, we do the analysis, we get to the end of the analysis, and we can't find it, and we hold on in our mind that non-finding, say, my God, it isn't there. It doesn't exist. There is no findable Christine in this heap of stuff, in these aggregates, in these skanda, right? We got mind and we got body. Well, okay, take away the mind and the body. Is it some other thing? This is very Christian, and which is the idea that it's the soul. This mind and body go away and we go to heaven as the soul, right? There's this third thing. Okay, well, if it is this third thing, the soul or whatever it is, then that's what it is to be Christine, and it's findably that, that's all. But then it has no, if that's what it is, then it has really no relation to a body and a mind. So the body and a mind could never affect it in any way because that's what it is. This whole idea that there's this thing in us that's us is this independent entity, this self-subsistent, independent thing. Now, you got to take that really seriously. The idea that it's independent means inherently what it is in itself. That needs to be taken really philosophically, very, very seriously. Because if that's what it is, it has no relationship to anything that's changing. Because it was always that and it'll always be that. It had nothing to do with our experiences. It has nothing to do. You couldn't experience anything because it's always what it is. It's this almost like a God, right? It's this thing that's independent of everything. It's inside of this and it's independent. Therefore, it could never have an experience. It could never change. It could never be born. It could never die. It could never, nothing could ever happen to it. It's always what it is. It's always continually what it is. And this is really important because this completely refutes everything we know. There is no such thing that doesn't change. There is no such me, person, that makes any sense. There's no sense of personhood that makes any sense that can't experience, that can't change. Our whole sense of personhood is built on change. If I do this, then this will happen. It's all built on cause and effect, which is one of the bases of Buddhism, is the whole idea of karma and cause and effect, right? If I do this, I'll change. If I do this, it causes harm. If I do this, it causes something good. I accrue merit or I don't accrue merit. We have this sense of ourself as this changeable and subject to change thing. We're constantly having experiences. Experiences of change. We don't feel that we're at all the same person that we were as a two-year-old. I mean, most of us would not volunteer to be a teenager again, right? Because we wouldn't want to have to go through being so stupid and so driven by hormones again. We're so glad we have some wisdom, right? But that's a sense, that's an affirmation of the fact that we're not the same thing, that we have changed, that there's some sense of person, a real valid sense of person that's really changing all the time. But if we were like this thing, this horse thing, underneath all of these changes, that horse essence never changed at all. It was never subject to change. In fact, there might as well not have been any colors or things because that thing is independent of all those things. It's a thing that kind of holds them all up, but it doesn't really have anything to do with them. It's the essence that stays there. So you get in Western philosophy a whole notion in Platonic philosophy of the realm, what they call the realm of ideas, what Plato calls the realm of ideas, where all these essences hang out. The essence of person, the essence of horse, the essence of sun and stars, the essence of the number two, they all hang out in the realm of ideas. And they just kind of come down and, like, touch these appearances once. They kind of, like, get dragged in with our thinking into the appearances. But they actually all are untouched in this God realm, right? Which is kind of like our notion of God, too, right? He hung out there all by himself, unconnected to anything, and all of a sudden, just out of the blue, decides that he's going to create things, right? But he doesn't have to create anything. The Christian idea of God is the God of substance. The Judaic God is the God of substance. He's totally unrelated. It's out of his goodwill, or he just suddenly one day decides, I'd like to have some other stuff around, you know. But actually those other things are totally superfluous. He's totally independent. He never changes. He's what he is. And in fact, it's totally logically contradictory that he could create anything else besides himself, because he's totally independent. If something is totally independent, it's totally independent. It can't be dependent and independent at the same time. So if you are dependent arising, you can't be independent at the same time. Buddhists are really good logicians. We're much better logicians than scientists and philosophers in general. Buddha was a superlative philosopher. He understood that if everything is a dependent arising, which is also extremely the essence of Buddhism. If everything is cause and effect, if everything depends on something else, if everything is related, it can't be unrelated. It just can't be that way. It's like something being, say, your shirt is white. It can't be at the same time black. It's either white or it's black. It can't be white and black unless it's got stripes. It can't be totally white and totally black at the same time. These two things are, they're incompatible. We can't have something be blue and green at the same time. It's either blue or it's green. It's red or it's green. It can't be both. So if, in fact, we have experiences, if we grow older, if we can change, if we can become better or worse, it totally denies that we're this thing that doesn't change, that there's this thing underneath there that's this findable, unchangeable essence. The facts of our life totally deny our immediate experience, which is that that I am this thing. So we've got this wrong view confronted by all the facts of our existence and all the facts of philosophy. All of the way we think logically, if we're very logical, and the whole analysis we do is to combine the facts of what really exists with our wrong view, with our wrong belief, this mistaken view that we've got inside, that there's this unchanging, permanent, in the sense of always the same entity, this entity. So we find it through analysis, but when we don't do analysis, we don't find it. So we need to do certain kinds of meditation in which we apply an analysis during our meditation. When we're not, so we have, in Buddhism, we also have a notion of two truths, two levels of truth, or two kinds of truth. We've got what we call conventional truth and ultimate truth. And they apply, the both of them apply to these two senses of I or self we have. One of them applies to the valid sense of I, and one of them applies to the invalid sense of I. The valid sense of I, this mere appearance of ourselves, yeah, you know, today I'm this, tomorrow I'm that, I'm still here, I should do something good, not bad, blah, blah, blah. That applies to the level of conventional. That's this mere appearance, when we just appear to ourselves, or to other people appear to us, or chairs and tables appear to us. That's the conventional level. That's the level of appearances. Just mere appearance. We don't substantialize it. We don't concretize it. It's just like kind of, you know, when we're just like busy with things, we kind of, things just kind of float through. We kind of float through things. There's this kind of like everything's there, yeah, but we're not like grasping onto it. It's just like, it's kind of like periphery vision, you know, peripheral vision. It's kind of like out of the sight. That's okay. That's conventional truth. And that's merely designated. I just use this every day as if it were the same Christine, right? And this appearance, this mere appearance, this continuum of mind and body is the one that I can designate. I can't say that you're the Christine. You're another set of causes and effects that support the designation Iris or Tara or Miss Kitty or whatever. There are these causes and effects, this chain of dependent arising that can support correctly the designation Christine. But there's no permanent thing hanging out here that's this thing, right? So that's conventional truth. Ultimate truth, it deals with the wrong view. It deals with this wrong view of I. Ultimate truth is a denial that thing even exists at all. So ultimate truth is the absence of that findable, concrete, substantial thing. That's what ultimately, you don't exist that way. Ultimately, there is no such thing. Even though you have this really strong sense of you, the ultimate truth is that thing is not there, cannot be found there. That kind of existence is not real. It has to do, ultimate truth has to do with the way you exist. You aren't findably substantially there. It doesn't have to do with the fact that you exist. It has to do with a particular way that you feel that you exist. So what's being denied is not that I exist as a person, but that I exist in a certain way. That I exist as this findably substantially existent being. That invisible horse behind all of those appearances. That's what's being denied. And why is it invisible? Because it doesn't exist. You didn't find it because it's not there. So the doctrine of ultimate truth is a doctrine that didn't invent anything. It simply tells you what really exists and what doesn't exist. And the ultimate truth is you don't exist the way you experience yourself to exist. And you don't substantially find it to exist. That's your ultimate truth. Because if you existed the way you feel that you exist, you couldn't exist as you exist. That's a good one. If you existed the way you really feel that you exist, you couldn't have an experience. You couldn't change. You couldn't become enlightened. You could not be liberated. You never would change. Nothing would ever happen. If things existed the way we feel or see them to exist, this wrong view that's mixed up with them, nothing could happen. Nothing would come into being, nothing would change, nothing would be born, nothing would die, no one would become Buddha, no one would become liberated, there would be no saints, there would be nothing. Nothing. Nothing that we experience in this world could have, could be the way it is. So if things existed the way we experience them to exist, this world is impossible. Liberation is impossible. So Buddha says, if you understand, Nagarjuna, who was the great saint in India 400 years after the Buddha was born and died, said that if you understand emptiness, if you understand the doctrine of no self, then everything is possible. But if you don't understand it, nothing is possible. And not only that, if you don't understand it, you'll never be liberated. Because why? Because this view is what roots all of your wrong attitudes, all of your deluded views, all of your afflictive emotions, and it's what causes you to accumulate karma. Because it's the grasping on to things as if they existed in this way that leads to suffering. We want that thing. Not because it's a thing that's changing moment to moment. We want it because it's not changing. We want to hold on to it. We want you to understand that we're fundamentally good persons and that Hitler is essentially bad. We're going to hate him forever. Why? Not because he did something wrong in one lifetime or that he had that moment did bad things, but because he's essentially a bad person. We're going to put people in jail. Because they're essentially bad people. In their essence, somehow underneath that, they're forever bad. We're going to want a person in a relationship because they're essentially that person. And when they die, we're going to grieve them forever because that thing is gone. That thing could never be gone if it really existed the way we thought it did. But every day that person is not being that person we thought they should, they are, right? Every day they're slamming up against us and getting us upset. Why are we upset? Not because they weren't always that way, that they aren't always changing, but because they're not the person that they're supposed to be. They're the person that loves us and is nice to us, and that thing never should change. And every time it does, we get pissed off, or we get surprised and happy because suddenly they're nice to us again, and that's the way they're supposed to be. That's the root of our problem, is that wrong view. So if we get rid of that, we get rid of all of our suffering. And this is why people spend their lifetime practicing the doctrine of emptiness. This is why arhats in the Theravadin tradition spend so much time in their meditation on the essence of things, on their emptiness meditation, on their no-self meditation. They don't do it because it's fun, because it's not. They don't do it because it's easy, because it's not. They don't do it because other people say it's a nice thing, because they won't. This is something that undoes everything that you are, everything that you're involved in, everything that you've ever done in the past. This is going the opposite. This is walking upstream and everybody else is going downstream. So you don't get any pats on the back for this. You don't get any encouragement from the world for this. People don't appreciate it. They don't even understand when His Holiness sits down to teach this that He just taught them about the most important thing in their whole life. They don't understand that every time they open their eyes, they miss the most important thing about everything they see and everything they experience, which is the way it exists, the true nature of reality. They don't understand. They're happy to go on not understanding. This is the ultimate nature of things. The absence of this substantial existence is the most important feature of every single object and phenomenon, including yourself. This is its essential essence, that it doesn't have a findableness. And this is what will undo everything for you. This is the key to liberation. If you understand this, you'll be able to meditate. If you can meditate on it, you'll eventually be able to become a liberated person. You'll become an arhat in the Theravadin tradition. And in the Bodhisattva tradition, it's a Bodhisattva at a certain level of, it's essential for every Buddhist to get this. Now, what aren't we denying? You get a sense of what we are denying, but you know there's an important fact in the Buddhist tradition is that we adopt the middle way. There's two extremes here, and it's really easy. Because these two kinds, this valid and invalid sense of a self, are so wound up together inseparably in our minds and in the way we see things, it's really easy to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's very easy for us to, when we deny that horse essence, to deny there's a horse at all. It's very easy, once we get our hands on that, to throw the entire thing out and end up with no Iris, no Christine, no Tara, no cat, no dogs, no horses, no nothing. Anything goes. Karma goes out the window because there isn't any person anymore. Because we denied it. Right? But that's not true. What did we throw out? We didn't throw out the mere person. This dependent thing that's changing over time. This mind and body complex. Changing over time, these mental states and physical states that are slowly accumulating karma, that express past karma, that are passing on karma moment to moment, physically and mentally, to the next mental and physical moment. We're not denying that. We're denying only that it exists in a certain way, that it exists as this findable, fixed thing. That's what we're denying. We're not denying this person. We're just denying that it exists in a certain way. And this is really important, because if we deny too much, we fall into nihilism. And this is why people are told by Buddha, by Nagarjuna, by Chandrakirti, by all the great teachers, is that if you find that you're falling into too much of a negation, then maybe it's better that you just kind of back off the whole subject. So if you find that you're ending up with nothing instead of something, you've gone too far in the other direction. You need to back off. You need to back up into the middle. And it's the reason that it's very difficult to decide when to teach this to people is because if you lead people to that extreme, it's extremely bad. It's the worst thing you can do for somebody. And it's terrible karma for the future. So you need to be very careful about teaching. And teaching this, my experience is that when I really teach this to people, people's lives really, when they get it, they really change, and not always for the better, because it's a thing when you teach it that undoes people's lives. They don't anymore. If people really get this, it's very difficult. An ordinary life is so embedded in the wrong view. It is soon as you start getting the right view, the ordinary life starts unraveling. It becomes, it's automatic. It's automatic. It's when you get the right view, the whole complex that leads to suffering starts to undo. Because you got the right view. You say, you go out to grab the thing and you grab onto it and you got it, and then in the back of your mind this thing says, but you don't have it. Because there's no it there to have. That thing that you're trying to hold on to, it isn't there. You're trying to hold on to something that's never changing. That's never, all your expectations are about that thing being this concrete, findable, this permanent thing. That's what you're holding on to. You're not holding on to something that's changing moment to moment because you wouldn't hold on that tight. So it starts to undo things. And what happens is that some people's lives get very difficult because they're trying to live with one foot in one and one foot in the other. And they've got a pretty deep sense of emptiness. And then they've got this sense of wanting to continue as if nothing happened. And it doesn't work very well. So that for some people, that gets to be very difficult. That's a very, very difficult thing. And for me, it was extremely difficult because at a certain point, it became not a 3-year retreat, it became a life. When I really finished my 3-year retreat, there wasn't anything for me to do anymore. I couldn't go back and do what I was doing because I had so profoundly undone. I had to say, now what? I've got this really profound sense of this. It was like I've been hit by lightning or something. It was really hard to like go back to the pre-lightning stage of this so profoundly. So this really has a big impact on a person's life. When you really start doing these meditations, it has a profound impact on the way you see everything, the way you engage in all your relationships, the way you value things, what becomes important, what's not important. It really has a, because it's getting at the fundamental problem. And it starts to unravel the fundamental problem. And as the fundamental problem unravels, things, your whole life changes. The whole way you see your world changes. And you see this in the stories of people who have the experiences of this. Holiness says that in this book he relates in the How to Practice book he says that he's got a little story. He said sometime during the early 60s when I was reflecting on a passage by Tsongkhapa, who's the founder of the Gelu Order, which is this Holiness's order, Tibetan Buddhism, about unfindability, so a passage in Tsongkhapa about unfindability, and the fact that phenomena are dependent on our concepts, on our thought, that we merely designate each thing as if it were. We just say, now I'm using, these are the things that I can use as Iris, these are the things I use as, this is, I'm designating this as Christine. It's this changing thing, but I'm merely saying that this changing thing is the same thing over time, right? It's not that there is anything there. I'm just saying, okay, now that's Christine. Okay, now that's Christine. Okay, now that's Christine. It's like saying a flickering candle, for example. We feel like there it is, right? We've got a candle and it's flickering off and on. And we say, okay, but where is that flickering candle? When the flame is off, there's no candle. When the flame is on, there's no flickering. It's when it goes off. A flame goes on and it goes off. And then another flame comes and another, it goes off. And we call that series of events a flickering candle. That's what, we just designate that as the flickering candle. And we can't say that that piece of wood is a flickering candle because it's not the right kinds of things happening. It's not the right causes and effects and series of effects and causes that we can use as that. We have that convention that that's what it is to be a flickering candle, and I'm not a flickering candle, right? I mean, a flickering candle is a certain series of causes and effects, right? And I'm a certain series of causes and of effects, mental and physical, a complex of those things. That's what I call. That's Christine, right? But it's always changing. There's nothing like staying there. So His Holiness reads this passage, and He says, "It was as if lightning coursed through my chest." Here's the passage. "A coiled rope, speckled color and coiling are similar to those of a snake. And when the rope is perceived in a dim area, the thought arises, that's a snake. As for the rope at that time when it seemed to be a snake, the collection and parts of the rope are not even in the slightest way a snake. Therefore, the snake is merely set up by conceptions. In the same way, when the thought I arises in dependence on my mind and body, nothing within the mind and body, neither the collection, which is a continuum of earlier and later moments, nor the collection of the parts at one time, nor the separate parts, nor the continuum of any of the separate parts, is even in the slightest way the I. Also, there is not even the slightest something that is different from those mind and body parts in the continuum that is apprehendable as me, as that I. Consequently, the I is merely set up by concepts, in dependence on the appearance of mind and body, of those changing elements, those causes and effects, those dependent arising. It is not established by way of its own entity. It isn't findably inside of those things." He says, "The impact lasted for a while, and for the next few weeks, whenever I saw people, they seemed like magicians' illusions in that they appeared to inherently exist. They appeared to be there substantially, but I knew that they actually did not. That experience, which was like lightning in my heart, was most likely at a level below completely valid and incontrovertible realization of emptiness. But this is when my understanding of the cessation of the afflictive emotions as a true possibility became real. Now I always meditate on emptiness in the morning and bring that experience into the day's activities. Just thinking or saying the word I, as I'm going to do this and that, will often trigger the feeling, but I still cannot claim full understanding of emptiness." So he has this really strong sense of, now this happened to me, and I also had this happen, and it lasted for weeks, and it's just an incredible thing. And I can't say that's the complete realization of emptiness, but once it really gets in you, like he said, then he looks at everybody and he knows, he's got the knowledge, it appears that way still, but he's got this knowledge, and it just undoes it, and it's like there's a play going on. It's almost, to me, the best analogy for me is it's almost like looking at a mirror image of everything. Like you see yourself in a mirror and you don't try to protect that mirror image. Like if you see like a hammer over it or something, you try to protect you, not the image in the mirror, right? You don't like try to take care of it or save it or anything. You don't worry about it. You see it, you merely see it, right? But it's not you. It's not like there's some you in it. You know, it's just these appearances, right? And that those are appearances, a reflection of something that you designate as you, but it takes away that kind of, I very often use a mirror when I'm meditating, because it's very useful, because it takes away that thing that I'm trying to grab at. It becomes emptied out in a way of that grabbable, findable thing. It's all, like, it looks, it's all the looks and everything, and I can say that's Christine as opposed to, that's an image of Christine rather than a image of something else, but it doesn't, I'm not grabbing onto it. I pull back from it in some way. There's some kind of release that I feel when I think about that. Now, I'm not just a mirror image of me, because I actually can perform the functions in my mirror image can't. I can perform, these aggregates can actually perform the function of a self, whereas the mirror image can't. So I'm not just an image, and I'm not just an illusion. I'm real, but I'm not real in the way I see myself. So there's, in a nutshell, the doctrine of emptiness. This is basically it. So if I believe what I see and experience, I believe that there's something substantially there, and that's fine. But if I go then to the opposite extreme and say there is no person, there is no accumulator of karma. There is no person that's accumulating karma all the time. There is no person at all. Then I'm going too far into denial. My job is to get a view that's down the middle, which holds on to persons as people, as things that accumulate karma, as real, as functional, as, but not as real in the way I experience it. And as soon as I can take that piece out, I'm on my way to liberation. Before that, I'm just digging myself in deeper. So even if I do positive deeds all my whole life, I'm, you know, Florence Nightingale my whole life, and I don't understand the doctrine of envy, I'll never be liberated from that. I can do as much good as I want, and I've done it with all of you. Because embedded in all that goodness is a wrong view of those people and things that I'm benefiting. So it's not that I'm not benefiting, but I'll never attain enlightenment. I'll never become liberated by being Miss Goody Two-Shoes for every existence from now on. I have to be Miss Goody Two-Shoes with the right view. I have to accumulate merit with the right view. So I have to not only be ethical, but I have to be ethical with the correct view of the way things really exist. Because otherwise, I just dig myself in. All those things are going to make me feel better because I'm a good person, a findably good thing, and I'm going to, those things are findable things that I'm going to benefit, and all I'm doing is just getting, strengthening that view of how things exist, and they don't exist that way. And if I realized how they exist, I'd undo it. Then my good deeds become actual causes of, real causes Buddhahood, because they're actually based on the right view. It's not that they're not meritorious, but they're meritorious with a severe flaw. So we want to get the right view. And that's the path to sainthood or arhatship in Theravadan or Hinayana tradition. That's the basis of bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas have to have that view. That's the basis of the tantric tradition. The whole tantric tradition is, starts with that view. And all of Buddhist practice revolves around that sense of no-self. Now there are different senses of no-self even within, different degrees of radicality of no-self within the Buddhist traditions. And they run a gamut. A view that is merely this view of no, like a no soul or substantial thing within a person, to a no findable thing at all. No findable chairs, tables, not only persons, but all other things. And there are different kinds of variations of the understanding which take you through various degrees of thoroughness of no self. Each one of them is a step on the way to the next one. But if you realize emptiness and become an arhat, or if you realize emptiness as a bodhisattva path in Mahayana, or if you realize emptiness on the tantric path, you realize exactly the same thing, which is that there is no findable self. And if you do it with a person, if you're doing the meditation on personhood, when you finally not only just have a correct understanding, but you've meditated long enough to have a complete realization of that, in which your mind, as it were, melts into, becomes one with this state, right? There's no object, no subject. You just become, it pervades everything, right? This non-findability. That state is immediately applies to everything. You see that that's the nature of everything. And then when you come out of that, anything you look at, you realize it applies to it. And you'll go back into the meditation, and then you'll go back into that state, no matter what you're meditating on the self of after that. So in the Prasangika tradition, we say that everyone who realizes emptiness realizes the same thing. A complete realization of emptiness is a perfect realization of emptiness, no matter what tradition you're practicing. So there's no difference. You can't be an arhat. You can't be liberated at all if you don't understand emptiness completely. And even if you start with just one notion of it, what happens is as you deepen it, it'll gradually universalize to all phenomena. And that's a test of your meditation, actually, in my tradition is that if you do the analysis of self and you deepen it and deepen it and deepen it, if you're able to immediately switch objects, like think about the door or the wall or whatever, and immediately see that the emptiness of that thing, immediately understand that, then you've got the right view. If you're not able to do that, you don't have the right view because it's, you've got a more limited view of emptiness. So this is one, like a little test you do when you meditate. And this is also why your meditation spaces are very simple. You try to have your meditation space very, very simple. You don't want too many objects. You don't want to have it too cluttered. You make everything as simple as you can because you're going over and over and over the object and the objects in your space until everything around you only reminds you of emptiness. So you keep everything very, 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 very simple. So the fewer things you have around it, there are fewer things to do the analysis on and fewer things to have to... If there's like a whole bunch of crap everywhere, then you can't like you can't go on everything and say I've done everything and there's nothing left that I haven't found that for. Everything here, every time I sit down, will remind me of it. So the thing is to keep everything very, very simple. And as you do the meditation, you just want everything to be very simple because as you go on, you realize none of it. It's like I can throw that. So what happened with my 3-year retreat is I just kept getting rid of stuff. Things just kept going out the door. So I was like, I started with a house and I ended up with a kind of shell and a meditation room and a sofa and some books, and that was it. By the time I was done, I had no clothes in the closet except like 2 clothes that I was wearing. I didn't have any things. Because it was like bothering me, you know, it was like everything kept. So in the process of 3 years, I ended up doing my entire house got cleaned out, you know. It was like, it was really an amazing thing because it was. It just undid everything. I mean, I woke up one morning and I realized I had 2 closets full of clothes and I only wore 2 things. And so I packed them all up that day and I put them outside and they were gone. You know, and that was, I didn't need them. There wasn't anything. They were just a bother. They were a burden mentally for me. And they were just two. They were 2-3 boxes of stuff I had to get rid of, you know, and it was like, one day I woke up and I had to get ordained, you know, and I was like, why did, that was the last thing, I didn't know, that was suggested right off, and that was not my high on my list, and I realized the only reason I wanted to be ordained was because I had to get rid of a lot of stuff that not being ordained was bringing me, and it was just like, it was another series of boxes of stuff I could put outside, and I didn't have to deal with it, I didn't have to explain why I was doing what I was. Explain why I didn't have a boyfriend or a girlfriend. I didn't have to explain why I didn't worry about my clothes or I didn't worry about my hairdo or didn't wear makeup. There were all these things I didn't, you know, I could put outside the door and I didn't have to. So, yeah, okay, ordain me, right? So then I got ordained by His Holiness Tetsun Rinpoche. It was simply house cleaning for me to become ordained. It wasn't an issue anymore. You know what I mean? It was the product of 3 years of meditation that said, God, I don't want to have to, I can't deal with all, this is like, it's getting in my way, you know. And I was alone in this room for 3 years. I mean, there wasn't like anybody beating down my door to be my boyfriend or my girlfriend or anything. It was just that it was waiting out there for me to open the door. And I didn't want to open the door anymore. Door was shut, you know. So it does have a profound effect. It did change my life. It sent me to India for 12 and a half years. It ruined my health. I lived there for 12 years. And it made me happy. And I guess I would trade anything for what it gave me. So, this is all I really have to say about it right now. I think this is the basic thing. There are lots of... This whole book is like about the ins and outs of it. His Holiness teaches for weeks on that topic. And he also teaches for one morning. And what I did was try to get it all in his one morning version instead. And the thing is, if you get what I said a little bit, you'll start to understand what the problem is. Start to understand what we're denying. We're only denying something that's not there anyway. We're not denying anything that exists. And the important thing about the middle way is we hold on to what exists and we get rid of what doesn't exist, the illusion. So we don't deny persons and things and phenomena and worlds and karma and all of that, but we get rid of this illusion that there's this thing there that exists in a certain way. And all our problems we just the solution comes from saying, hey, it's not there anyway, so we don't need to hold on to it. And that's our freedom. And that's where liberation comes from. So this is basically the doctrine of it.